We will start our calendar this morning with the Guarini versus Maine and the Cassidy versus Maine cases. I understand that you both have already spoken to one another and to our clerk with respect to how you're going to handle these cases. As I have indicated, I believe through my clerk and she, the court clerk, and she confirmed, if you do not need your entire 60 minutes, please feel free to use the argument time in the best way possible that you feel will serve your clients. And with that, are the parties ready to proceed? Mr. Johansson, Mr. Leslie, very well. This is 62826, Guarini versus Maine.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brandon Johansson on behalf of the appellants, Richard Cassidy and Anthony Guarini.
And let me, for the record, be sure that I call into the record case number 64015, which is the Cassidy case number. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors. And I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I will not likely be taking the whole 30 minutes, so hopefully I won't keep you here too long today. But I would like to thank the court for granting our request to combine the hearings today. Although these cases aren't consolidated, they present identical legal issues, with the only differences being small factual issues that aren't at issue in this appeal. The underlying petitions are essentially the same. They can contain similar allegations, and the reasoning in the orders denying or granting the motions to dismiss the petitions are essentially the same. And the issues before this court in this case are whether the district court properly granted the respondents' motions to dismiss the appellant's petitions for declaratory relief, and whether the district court erred in failing to allow the appellants leave to amend their petitions. And the district court, in dismissing the petitions, primarily relied upon this court's ruling in Niddle and found that the appellants failed to establish certain underlying facts, underlying liability, which precluded bringing a declaratory relief action. However, the court's ruling was improper for a couple different reasons. One, there's nothing under the statutory scheme of NRS Chapter 30 that requires underlying facts to be proven before a declaratory relief action can be brought. And second, the facts in Niddle are completely different than what we have here, and the holding in that case was very specific to the circumstances that were presented in that case. And so first, looking at the statutory scheme of the Declaratory Relief Act, there's nothing in the Act that requires underlying facts to be established. And in fact, if you look at Chapter 30, it contemplates that facts can be determined by the court. NRS 30.110 specifically states that where proceeding involves the determination of an issue of fact, such issue may be tried and determined in the same manner as issues of fact are tried and determined in other civil actions in the court in which the proceeding is pending. So the statute specifically contemplates that underlying facts can be established. And further, looking more in the statute, if you look at NRS 30.050, which deals with contract issues and declaratory relief, in there it says that you don't even have to have a breach of a contract before you bring a declaratory relief action. And so there's no requirement that any underlying liability be established.
What declaration would you be asking the district court to make here? Like if you won and wishes were horses, what would the district court say?
Yeah, and that's a good question, Your Honor. And looking at the petitions that were filed by my clients, they're not a model of clarity. They're difficult to parse through. They were drafted by pro se litigants who aren't schooled in the law, and so it's difficult to kind of parse through it. But because they're pro se litigants, courts are to liberally construe the pleadings and look at.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, if they now have the benefit of your representation, and one of the issues that's intriguing to me in this is the denial of the motion to amend, and I'm thinking, what declaration exactly is it that is sought here, or is it relief that they're seeking damages or some other form of relief might remediate?
Well, they're not seeking monetary damages, and I think there's kind of a two-part answer to your question. First, you have to look at what kind of relief can be afforded in a declaratory relief action. NRS 30.040 provides that any interested party whose rights, status, or other legal relations are affected by statute, ordinance, contract, or franchise may have determined any question of construction or validity arising under the instrument, statute, ordinance, contract, or franchise and obtain a declaration of rights, status, or other legal relations thereunder. And looking at the petitions liberally, there's certain allegations that are made in both petitions. They both allege that they're incarcerated, that they're prisoners. They both allege that there are various statutes and administrative regulations that apply to them as prisoners.
Basically, didn't they just say that they want to have the court, any court, this court, the lower court, declare that the guards have to do their job? Isn't that really the essence of what their petitions look like?
If you look in the petitions, they do say that. But I think, again, when you look at it liberally and broadly construe them, I think it's a little bit more than that. And so in their petitions, they allege that a search and seizure occurred, and they allege in there that those policies and procedures related to the search and seizure weren't properly followed, that they violated those internal procedures. So I think that their actions can be construed as a facial challenge to the policies and procedures that were in effect when their cells were searched. And it's a declaratory relief action that those statutes, those procedures and policies were violated when they did the search and seizure.
Well, I think what was that? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that was basically it, because I think on Mr. Guarini, he wanted to watch the officer search his cell and go through the material. I think he says so he didn't mess it up or whatever like that. Was there anything else that I was trying to figure out what the officers were doing wrong in their point of view?
Well, as alleged in the petitions, which we have to take the facts as pleaded as true, they allege several things. Under the regulations, and they cite to the regulations and the petitions, one of them is when you do a search that everything has to be put back in place as you found it. The appellants allege that didn't occur in this case. As Your Honor mentioned, there's also procedures that when a cell is searched, you're supposed to be able to observe that, unless there's other circumstances where the safety of the officer is involved, then they can't.
Alleged in this case.
Which was alleged, but then there's also procedures that when that happens, when the inmate is taken away, that you're supposed to have, I believe, two guards there to watch the search. And another thing that's alleged in the petitions is that they took some of their personal property and that they didn't follow the procedures in documenting that. And I think those are all alleged in there, and they allege that those would all be violations of the procedures that are in place. And broadly construing the complaint, they're seeking a declaration that those procedures weren't properly filed, that they violated those procedures.
Property was returned, wasn't it? At least, as I recall, the shoes were certainly returned to Mr. Guarini, is that correct?
Correct. They were returned, but that doesn't nullify the fact that the procedures weren't necessarily properly followed when they were originally taken. And so I think broadly construing the complaint and liberally looking at it, there is a declaratory relief claim in there for determination that the policies and procedures were not properly followed, that they were violated. And even going beyond that, kind of the second part of the second issue that we have is the court didn't afford leave to amend the complaint. And if Your Honors look at the orders that were actually issued, let me step back. The case law on this says that dismissal without leave to amend is only proper when it's absolutely clear that nothing can be done to correct the deficiencies in the complaint. And if Your Honors look at the orders that were actually entered in this case, it's clear that even the district courts believe that there was a proper way to do this, but they just didn't like the method that was done. Looking at the order that was entered in the Cassidy matter, the court said, these allegations may be legally sufficient for the purposes of a civil complaint, but are insufficient as a matter of law for the purpose of declaratory relief. In the Guarini case, the district court said that any relief available to the petitioner is only available by virtue of a properly pleaded and filed civil lawsuit. So in here, the district court is essentially admitting that, yes, you have underlying facts that could serve as a basis to bring a proper claim, but you filed it as a declaratory relief action, and we don't think that's proper, so we're just going to dismiss the case. What the court should have done is the court should have granted leave to amend to allow the petitioners the opportunity to assert a claim, either clarify their declaratory relief claim or to assert other claims. And I think that the respondents in their brief that they agree with this too. They admit in their opposition that the appellants that they exhausted all of their administrative remedies, but the issue that they have is they failed to pursue proper legal course, and that they should have done something else, such as file, for instance, a 1983 action and assert some sort of...
Well, let's ask you this, and this kind of goes back to Justice Pickering's original question. Let's say we agreed with you on the leave to amend, and now you're going to amend. What are you going to say in the amendment regarding both of these gentlemen as to what you're asking for in the way of declaratory relief?
Well, I think, for instance, you can take the example of a 1983 action. They could amend their petitions to assert a 1983 claim, and in that, they could assert a claim that their property was misappropriated when it was taken from their cells, when they didn't follow procedures.
That's a damage case, isn't it? You'd be suing for damages then.
Correct. They could be seeking damages for the violation of their constitutional rights when their property was misappropriated. And they've alleged the underlying facts that would support that type of claim. And I think that the district court, that they should have granted leave to amend to allow them to try to seek that recourse. And again, just to touch on the district court's ruling on the reliance on the Niddle case. That case concerned a plaintiff that filed an action against a defendant for tort damages. And in that same action, the plaintiff also filed a declaratory relief action against the defendant's insured. And in that case, the Supreme Court, in looking at it, they looked at a case from the Colorado Supreme Court, they looked at the Utah Court of Appeals case, and this court rightly decided that no, you cannot bring a declaratory relief out. A plaintiff cannot bring a declaratory relief action against the defendant's insured when no liability has been proven in the underlying lawsuit. And
because it's contingent.
Correct. And that
how is this contingent here? Your point is that it's not, correct? In other words, it's a fait accompli. Whatever happened, happened.
Sort of. I mean, in that case, it was taken in a specific context of a plaintiff suing the defendant's
insurer.
And the case went on to specifically note, though, in the context of the defendant suing his own insurer, that's proper. And that happens all the time to determine
coverage. Right. Right to defend, for example, does the insurer owe a duty to defend? I mean, I get the insurance company context is different, but here... I still am not clear on what declaration of rights they want. It sounds a lot to me like they want them to follow the law. I'm not sure Niddle applies, I guess, but I'm still not sure dec relief is the...
Well, I mean, they have alleged certain facts that will have to be taken as true. I mean, again, we go back to the fact that the search and seizure occurred and that our clients allege that they didn't follow, that the respondents didn't follow the proper procedures. And kind of going back to my original statement, that what they're really doing, liberally construing the complaint, is the facial challenge of the policies and procedures that were not properly followed by the respondents. And I was looking and thinking about this. I asked the question, well, what remedy would be available to them if they were to pursue this action? And, I thought about it for a while, and I was just kind of flipping through some of the administrative regulations. And there's a section that talks about remedies for grievances. And one of the remedies states as follows. appropriate measures to protect inmates from criminal or prohibited acts committed by departmental employees and staff or other inmates. And that's AR 740.082C.
I'm sorry, could you read those numbers again?
Sure, it's 740.082C.
Okay.
And so again, it says one of the remedies that is available to an inmate who procedures haven't been properly followed is to enact further measures to protect the inmates from criminal or prohibited acts committed by department employees. And I think in this case, the prohibited act would be the violation of the internal procedures. And here it said appropriate measures to make sure that those don't happen anymore. And so I think that that would be an available remedy to the appellants in their declaratory relief action. And so unless your honors have any further question, we'd ask that the district court's orders be remanded, or in the very least, that our clients would be allowed leave to amend. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johansson. Mr. Leslie.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Clark Leslie, Assistant Solicitor General. In listening to my esteemed colleague present the case and then some questions from this court, I was pleased to hear several things, but what struck me was your question, Justice Pickering, and your follow-up, Justice Seda. What would we fashion by way of an order if relief was granted? Well, when you engage in a cell search of an inmate, you must do the following. Well, wait a minute. We already have AR 422. When an inmate wants to view the cell search, well, we already have an administrative regulation to cover that. Well, when a property is taken or seized as possible contraband, the following must occur. Oh, wait a minute. There are specific procedures that are already on the books that provide specifically for that type of an event when it occurs. As I pointed out in the brief and as has been mentioned this morning, this is really nothing more than a demand that someone tell various members of the Nevada Department of Corrections follow the law. Those are not only disfavored, but they're not necessary.
What if it's true that, like, let's say that this is an inarticulately pleaded complaint, yet what's alleged is that there wasn't, that it was a sham, there was no legitimate fear for safety that required that, and I forget which petitioner, that he should have been allowed to watch what happened to make sure nothing was planted, that nothing was taken, et cetera, and that this was widely and routinely abused and without any legitimate fear for safety. It's a practice to do these without the inmate watching. What recourse would that inmate have to have that reviewed by a court if that practice were rampant and a problem?
A action could be filed under 42 U.S.C. section 1983 alleging a violation of Fourth Amendment rights for search and seizure, possibly under the Eighth Amendment for cruel and unusual punishment if it was a continuing source of conduct, and under the 14th Amendment, either because there was a violation of due process that is provided for in the ARs, or equal protection if for some reason there was an allegation that these particular inmates were being selected and picked out. Also, in terms of property, as you're well aware...
But wait a minute. What about that he doesn't want to necessarily dress the claim up in constitutional garb? He wants to say, follow the darn rule, and you're not following it. How would he remediate that?
Well, once again, under Section 1983, you can ask for relief that would state that the conduct that was being engaged in by the correctional officers was wrong, and it's going to subject them to damages. That, when you hit somebody in the pocketbook, you probably get their attention more than any other way.
So you're saying it's only a claim for compensatory damages that could be structured in that setting? They could possibly get an injunction or not.
Injunctive relief could be sought, and also under post-deprivation state laws, as the Hudson versus McMillian case stated in, from the United States Supreme Court, you can bring a property action in an appropriate court of jurisdiction. If it's under $5,000, you bring it in small claims. If it's above that, you bring it in a district court.
So if all that's true, then why should not leave to amend have been granted?
Because there are no set of facts that can be pled that would fall within declaratory relief under NRS 30-100.
But let's say he wants to change the complaint from DEC relief to something else. Should he have been allowed that opportunity? Or was that not what the argument was?
Well, there was no request to amend to bring forth a property claim or a Section 1983
okay.
claim. If they had, then I think it would have been error to not allow them to
right.
do so. But as this Court is very aware, where amendment would be futile, then amendment does not have to be provided, and it's best to just dismiss with prejudice and then have the matter determined on appeal. Let's recall that of the four elements that are required for declaratory relief, the district court found that two of those elements were missing. They found that there was a lack of a controversy, and that they found also that it was not ripe. And I've struggled with asking myself the question, and I, perhaps the court did as well when the question was asked, what order could be fashioned? Well, when you engage in certain activities with inmates versus all of that contact and conduct is set forth in the administrative regulations or in the Constitution. Perhaps you had the same sense that I did, and when I spoke to others about this, there was just a feeling that this is not the type of case that is appropriate for declaratory relief. And feelings and emotions don't count here. But there's a reason why there's an uncomfort, I think, or a discomfort when this type of a case is mentioned in context of declaratory relief. And that is, there are just so many things that have not been determined that this is not the vehicle or mechanism by which we want this type of dispute to be decided. All we know is that there was a cell search and that Correctional Officer Main was involved and that some property was taken. Now, beyond that, there is a universe of facts that have to still be determined in this case. Despite, and I was complimenting counsel on the quality of the briefs that they filed, their research was impeccable, but neither they nor I could find any analogous case in Nevada which required this type of fundamental fact-finding by a jury. And let me remind the court, neither one of the petitioners requested a jury trial in this case. I understand the court could sit as trier of fact, but, you know, that is of some significance. There has never been a case in Nevada that I know of where so many fundamental facts had to be determined. It's like you have the cart, but you don't have the horse. And they nonetheless want to proceed in the cart and say that they can go down the road even without the horses. Now, the reason I believe, and I think the record bears this out, and why NRS 30.110 was enacted was so that if some facts had to be determined, some minor facts or one or two facts had to be determined down the road, that problem would not by itself preclude a declaratory relief action from being brought. But as all of the cases point out, whenever you're talking about contingencies, about possible future events, and about whether or not a party would find a fault or a problem with an event that might occur in the future, declaratory relief is not the appropriate avenue for which relief can be obtained. Yes, in essence, what these petitioners are asking for is follow the law. But there first has to be a determination that the law was not followed. And if there had been some preliminary findings in this case, then perhaps that would be an appropriate mechanism. But there are so many undecided facts that it is more appropriate to seek relief at law rather than inequity. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll submit.
I have one question. In the declaratory relief context and a motion to dismiss, the briefs seem to assume that the normal standards of review apply, in other words, basically de novo, crediting every fair inference from the facts as pleaded, et cetera. But the appropriateness of declaratory relief in the final analysis is a discretionary matter. Do you have anything to offer on what standard of review should apply and whether it should be any different from the normal de novo review that we would apply to an appeal from a 12b-5 dismissal for failure to state a claim?
I would love to argue abuse of discretion or clear error, but I cannot. In all candor, I believe de novo review is the best approach.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Leslie. Mr. Johansson, you have 15 minutes and 5 seconds.
I'll do my best to take up that full 15 minutes and 5 seconds. I just want to make a couple of points. First, on the request for leave to amend, I do not believe that the appellants actually made that request. But again, we're talking about pro se litigants where the courts are supposed to liberally construe things and not just supposed to dismiss complaints where there could be a reasonable basis to allow the complaint to go forward, perhaps under different grounds. And we heard counsel just come up here and say, well, they chose the wrong vehicle. Well, and I read from the order, the district court seemed to think that the appellants chose the wrong vehicle. Well, if that's the case, that assumes that there's another vehicle available for them to get into and take off with the case. And the court simply did not give the appellants that ability to do that and to amend their complaint into a properly pleaded civil complaint, as the order says, and allow them to go forward with their claims. Counsel also made a comment about how there's just too many facts to be determined. There's not enough facts to be fleshed out. Well, that's why a case shouldn't be dismissed so early on in the pleading stages when all these facts need to be determined. And clearly under the statutory scheme for declaratory relief actions, that's allowed to happen. There's a couple cases that both respondents and us cited to, this court's decision in the Cox case and the Berliant case. And in both of those cases, they were both declaratory relief actions. And in both of those cases, the courts had to make factual determinations. Those cases were easement cases, and the courts had to make factual determinations. So that's clearly something that's appropriate for this court to do in declaratory relief actions, unless the court has any other further questions.
Well, I was going to ask you this because I was thinking about different ways this claim could be pursued. Let's say we agree with Mr. Leslie in this case and we affirmed, and who knows, we haven't even talked about it yet, but would your client have any recourse in filing a new lawsuit for 1983, or are there statute of limitations or claim issue and claim preclusion issues, or what's your thoughts on that? I mean, would he be deprived of his day in court on these disputes?
Well, I'm not exactly sure on the statute of limitation issues if that would run. That very well could be likely that if this case is dismissed and they have to file a new lawsuit, that the statute of limitations would have run and they would be rebarred. I also think that there could be some potential claim preclusion issues if this case dismissed and they try to refile it. And this just kind of, you know, brings me back to the remedies question. And again, I pointed out to the specific regulation that basically prospectively tells the prison officials that they need to take measures to protect the inmates from violations of the law, from doing prohibited acts. And again, arguably a prohibited act would be one where the prison officials are violating their own internal policies and procedures. And so there's this remedy found in the regulations is almost, in fact, a follow the law type of remedy that's available, although we would argue this isn't necessarily a follow the law case. Again, as I talked about earlier, you know, one of the interpretations of the petitions is they're seeking declaratory relief that the policies and procedures have been violated. And again, a remedy for that would be to would be for the prison officials to take measures to make sure that that doesn't happen in the future.
I just want to clarify.
Exactly. So is it your position that the leave to amend would not encompass a 1983 claim for damages? I mean, a 1983 claim could be brought in state court as well as federal court. It's concurrent jurisdiction. Or are you saying your clients want to live by the deck relief sword and die by it?
No, they could amend the complaint to bring a 1983 action and assert damages. And I think that there's underlying facts that they've already alleged in the petitions that would substantiate a claim for damages.
Okay, and so you're not ruling out that that might be within the pale of what they want to amend to state?
Correct. I mean, we haven't had specific discussions with...
But I'm not asking you to get into that, but I'm just, as you stand here today, are you saying if you can't have deck relief, you want nothing, or...
No, that they would be allowed to amend to file a 1983 action as well. That would be one of the available options for them.
I have a couple of questions, Mr. Johansson. And they may at least in part be outside the record, and so in that case, you probably won't be able to respond to them. Do you know why your clients failed to file a civil complaint? Why didn't they just file a civil complaint straight up?
Well, I guess that depends on how you define a civil complaint. A declaratory relief action is, at least in my mind, is a civil complaint. And I couldn't answer why they chose one vehicle as opposed to another.
And in any way, then, were your clients denied an opportunity to be heard on the record? Was there anything else that they would have added below that you feel they were denied?
As far as I understand, all of the, at least with respect to the instances outlined in the petitions, that they put in exactly what happened. And I don't know that there is anything else that they're at, although there could. I can't answer that for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice Gibbons, Justice Pickering?
Nothing else.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
These cases, both 62826 Garini and 64015 Cassidy, will stand submitted. And the court will be in recess until 11:30 for the call of the court.